Sandra Steingraber is an ecologist and author. Her most recent book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Steingraber will speak March 13th at Kalamazoo College's Dalton Theater. Her other works include Living Downstream. That book is also the basis of a documentary. Steingraber is a contributor to the Huffington Post and other media outlets, and she is currently a scholar in residence at Ithaca College in New York. Sandra Steingraber, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Something I did not mention in the beginning that people will find in any biography of you online is that you're a cancer survivor. You had bladder cancer at a young age. Did that change how you viewed the world around you and influence the path that you took in terms of writing and ecology?
It did. And I would say that in that way, it makes me no different than any other cancer patient. I think any cancer diagnosis is like a big cane coming in to the stage of one's own life and kind of pulling you off stage. And it changes every cancer patient's sort of the direction of their life and makes them re-examine priorities. I think if my case is untypical at all, it's because I was so young. I was in between my sophomore and junior year of college, so I was at that stage of life where big decisions are being made anyway about what one's going to study, what one's career path is. And so for me, who was a high-achieving biology major on my way to medical school, I suddenly realized that I didn't want the hospital to be my workplace anymore. Knowing that I was going to be a cancer patient and spending plenty of time in the backless blue cotton gown hooked up to IV drips anyway. And I should say that bladder cancer, of all human cancers, is the one most likely to recur. It has a good survival rate. It's not the worst cancer to be diagnosed with, but 70% of all patients have a recurrence. And so one leads a highly medicalized life. I go in and out of the hospital every few months. I had cancer screening checkups every few months, you know, for 35 years now. I'm 55 this year. And so it made me decide to go into biological research instead of medical school. And in addition, my own diagnosing physician began asking me questions about my childhood environmental exposures while I was still lying there exhaling anesthesia. Some of them had to do with worked in an aluminum smelter. Well, no, I hadn't, but I actually grew up not far from one. And so his questions rightly directed my line of inquiry as a young biologist down a path of asking what kind of environmental exposures might be the explanation for my situation. And then lastly, I brought another part of my identity to bear in all this, and that I'm adopted. So my mother actually was already diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer when I was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and we became co-cancer patients together. Then my aunt went on to die of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. But knowing I was adopted meant that I began to realize how, in our culture, many people, including my own doctors, presume that what ran in families necessarily runs in genes, and saw family cancers as hereditary cancers rather than maybe cancers of shared exposure. And so as a young biologist and as an adopted person, I was really interested in exploring that, because even my doctors would become flummoxed when they heard that, well, yes, actually there's bladder cancer in my family, but oh, by the way, I'm adopted. I mean, that didn't compute. So I became very interested in that. And so essentially then the relationship between human health and environmental health became my life's work, and I've now written a trilogy of books on that connection.
And as you say, your cancer came very early in life. 20 years old is not when we hear of a lot of people getting cancer. Are more of us probably being exposed to something and then taking decades before that cancer gets diagnosed?
Well, there is data to suggest that. And so the book that I closely look at, the relationship between environmental exposures and risk of cancer, is my book Living Downstream. And so for me, it's kind of two books in one. I went back to my hometown, a highly industrialized area along the Illinois River, and began an investigation of the kinds of chemicals that I knew from research were associated with bladder cancer to see what I could find. And so it didn't take too much sleuthing around to discover that I was just actually one data point in a cluster of cancers there. The cancer rate is significantly above average where I grew up. And then I began to look at what was in drinking water, had to file Freedom of Information Act requests and so forth. And so essentially, I tried to pull together two different databases that we dutifully collect, but no one routinely builds bridges between. One is the cancer registry data, which is a picture, a sort of a moving picture of the cancer trends over time and how cancer clusters itself over geographic space. And that's our cancer registry data. That's all collected by the cancer registrar in the public health departments of every state. And then, in addition, every state of the union keeps toxics release inventory data. This is actually gathered by our U.S. EPA, and it's gathered by a zip code. And so you can actually see where the toxic releases are and what the cancer rates are. It's just that it's not a lot of research is being done to try to bring those two together. So that's what I try to do with Living Downstream, not only from my own hometown, which is the kind of narrative of the book, is my own cancer diagnosis and my own little community, and then you see me as a cancer patient going back to ask that question that all cancer patients ask, why me? But I ask it in this very biological way, and I look to the environment, and I do find, I'll go ahead and give away the plot, I guess. I did find that the presence of bladder carcinogens in my hometown drinking water wells, probably caused by what we would now say it would be careless industrial practices years and years, decades before I was even born, probably involving machine shops. So that led me to ask, well, what are we doing now to see the causes of cancers in generations still to come, that when our children and grandchildren look back on this time now, they would say, what were you thinking? In the same way that when we look back at a time when DDT was routinely sprayed in neighborhoods and children were running behind the fog trucks, or when we see photographs of people smoking in airplanes, we would think, what were they thinking? Although some of us are old enough to remember when that was considered, normal and therefore harmless.
In your book, Raising Elijah, you introduce a term called well-informed futility. Explain what this means.
Yeah, that's the opening concept of the book, I would say, in Raising Elijah. And I wanted that to be my starting place because I had already at that point written a couple of books laying out the evidence for a link between, we've been talking about cancer in the environment, but the book after that I actually look at pregnancy and look at risk for miscarriages and learning disabilities, birth defects, and so on. Those are really scary topics for people. And so what I began to realize is that our inability to actually look at this evidence, we turn away from it reflexively. It seems depressing and overwhelming, and we don't really want to know. And so we're all being kind of good Germans about the signs of a really serious problem. And why is that? Why is it we can't take a look at this? And so one of my readers actually introduced me to the work of a German psychologist who had this concept that he had done some theorizing and research about, called well-informed futility. And for him, it referenced not the environmental crisis, but rather a phenomenon in the 1960s in which people who watched a lot of television news on the Vietnam War were less likely to take action. There's something about seeing these horrible pictures, which at the time, of course, the Vietnam War was the first war really televised in what we would call real time now, but is pretty close to it. And instead of galvanizing people, it had the opposite impact. So this psychological idea is basically this, that whenever there's a human problem over which we feel no agency, like we can't imagine that anything we could do to solve that problem, then we begin to feel unbearable feelings. They take the form of unbearable guilt, unbearable rage, or unbearable grief. But what it does is it compels us to turn away from any more knowledge about that topic because we can't bear those feelings. And so I wanted to resurrect that idea because I felt it had currency and meaning for our current age. Here we are in the midst of basically two twin crises, and this is what I'll talk about when I'm in Kalamazoo. First is, of course, what we've been talking about, which is this crisis of toxic contamination without consent. So our bodies end up being the repository of inherently toxic chemicals that we know, we have good data to show they alter our immune status, they can interfere with our hormones, they can break our chromosomes and raise the risk for cancer and so on. But we have a hard time dealing with that set of data. And then the other crisis, of course, is the climate crisis. And here we are hurtling toward a climate cliff now. We're at the point where we're beyond every little bit helps in terms of doing small things to get us on the right path to pull us back from calamity. And now we're at the last straw that breaks the camel's back point, and where we need to do huge changes to our energy system very rapidly and decarbonize as quickly as possible. And yet we're still not on wartime footing with this. We're not walking around having endless conversations at every coffee shop, at every dinner table, with every elected official about what we're going to do here. We're just unable to really look at the square in the eye. So I felt like until we deal with this phenomenon of well-informed futility and the way it creates a kind of existential paralysis in our hearts and in our political system, we're just not going to find the determination and resolve to go forward. And so Raising Elijah is an attempt to solve that problem. And I decided to embed the data and the analysis in a human story. And the book is named after my son, Elijah, who's now 12. So you see me as a biologist mother whose life's work is to study the climate crisis, to study toxic chemicals, and have all this data on what it means on my desk. And then meanwhile, I'm raising my kids and trying to keep them safe from harm and trying to plan for their future at a time when the environmental crisis is robbing me of both of those things. So how do I take what I know as a biologist and have it inform my parenting life? And so there's a lot of data in the book, but there's a lot of stories too. One of them, for example, is the night that I took Elijah out trick-or-treating when he was about 4. He had asked me to make a polar bear costume for him. He wanted to be a polar bear for Halloween. He called it a lightning bear. And so I'm actually pretty good at sewing, mostly because of all my work a long time ago in animal surgery. So all my sewing techniques come from actually sewing on animals. So I figured I was well-equipped to make an animal costume. So I actually took out a lot of my papers and my files about hermaphroditic polar bears, because polar bears are at the top of the food chain. They're in the Arctic, and there are all kinds of sexual disorders among polar bears. And so that's one of the things I've written about. And so I have whole files on polar bears. But I didn't want my son to actually see these files, right? Because all I always try to do is figure out how the ears look on a polar bear so I could make an accurate costume. And yet I realized I was hiding this knowledge I have from my kid. And I wondered how long could I do that? You know, sooner or later he's going to learn to read and he's going to see what's on my desk. And then that night when I was out in the street with him, here was my child, the polar bear, filling the streets with children who were dressed like Kermit the Frog and monarch butterflies and the little brown bat and the bumblebee. All these creatures are going extinct. They're in trouble. And so I was walking among children who had taken on the identity of animals who are all vanishing. And it hit me so hard, that unbearable grief, that exact experience of well-informed futility, that I actually fell to my knees in holding this plastic pumpkin full of Kit Kat bars, right? Realizing that children love these animals. They feel this kinship with animals. They're on their way to extinction, mostly because of climate. And we adults can't even have a conversation about it because we feel so bad about the whole situation. We don't know what to do. And yet it's our job as parents to ensure that the world goes on, that it abides, and there's a place for our children in it. And because the world needs bumblebees and other pollinators, right? Our kids need to eat. And so I got up off my knees, and the rest of the book is, what do we do once we get up off the floor? And it hits us like that. How do we act? And I hope I have some good ideas, both big and small, because we need political action as well as a willingness to show our children where we will alter the energy cycles and the food chains within our own households. But then we need also to be acting in larger ways to ensure that those good ideas are scaled up on a society-wide level. So you see me as one mom trying to carry this off and be a kind of superhero in the eyes of my children who think I'm capable of doing that.
Do we have to accept less convenience in some ways that we've come to expect in modern life in exchange for cleaner air and water and fewer health risks?
No, just the opposite, I would say. And here's where the good news begins. I mean, there's a few pieces of good news. So let me, and you just hit on one of them. Let me just articulate the other. You know, if I thought that cancer, for example, was simply in this inherited problem, that we inherited bad cancer genes and they just exploded at random and there was nothing we could do about that, that would be truly depressing. But instead, what the evidence shows us is that a large proportion of cancers are actually attributable to the things that people put into the environment, either chemicals or the way the built environment is created, forcing people, for example, to commute long distances behind diesel trucks and lead a sedentary life. Those are the kinds of things that explain the lion's share of cancers. And given that evidence, we as people can alter what we put into the environment and how we create a built environment. Whereas if the evidence had shown that it was our ancestors and the genes that we had inherited that were the problem, there'd be nothing we could do about that. That, in my mind, would be truly the depressing situation. And likewise, I think that the evidence is that should we move forward with innovations in green chemistry and green energy, that our lives simply get better, that there's a convenience in, for example, not being plunged into the cold and the dark every time there's a windstorm because a tree falls down on a power line. You know, if we had a different kind of energy grid, we wouldn't have to do what I myself ended up doing and so many people are doing and are doing now with the current ice storm that we're in, which is, you know, find themselves counting the number of logs they have to put into their fireplace and eating cold food and shivering. I mean, that's truly inconvenient. And it's amazing to me that our energy system is stuck in a kind of time capsule. I mean, the rest of the world moves on with this amazing innovation, and yet we're still shoveling coal into an oven and lighting it on fire. So in other words, we carry around now whole libraries in our pocket. We store data in iClouds. And yet we still power these devices by blasting fossil fuels out of the ground and torching them. And that hasn't changed for 150 years. So I hardly even know how to make a phone call anymore. My children communicate through platforms that are barely recognizable to me, things like Snapchat. And yet if you brought my great-grandfather back to life, he wouldn't know how to make a phone call, but he would know how to put gas in my car. The whole shoving the gas thing into your car hasn't changed since the 1920s. And so liberating, I think, investments in renewable energy, which are being held hostage, I think, by the fossil fuel industry, is really what I'm interested in. And that's what I'll talk about when I'm in Michigan, because I think the road to meaningful chemical reform also runs through our energy policy, because so much of the chemicals that I worry about as a biologist and their ability to expose people and then second create demonstrable health risks, those are chemicals that are brought to us because we build our materials economy out of the leftovers and the waste products from our energy system. In other words, we have coal ash in cement and in the walls of our homes because we have all this coal ash left over. We have plastic bags in a large part because the fracking industry not only blasts bubbles of methane out of our bedrock, but what comes up with the methane is also other hydrocarbons like ethane, and they don't know what to do with it. So we're going to build ethylene crackers now and make more plastic, and more fertilizers and more pesticides, not because there's a human need for these things necessarily, but because it's value added for the energy industry. So were we to leapfrog and decarbonize and get off of fossils and do something with our energy system that is analogous to what we've done with our telecommunications system, instead of doing the energy equivalent of continuously investing in the cathode ray tube and the rotary dial phone and this electric typewriter, then we would also, I truly believe, liberate all these great ideas about how to run our chemical economy. And so my feeling is that there's a lot of innovation in chemistry that's just waiting in the wings, that we can't really fully deploy until we get rid of the elephant in the room, which are fossil fuels.
Now, you brought up fracking. The defenders of fracking will say that natural gas is cleaner than oil or coal, and that the most of the solution which is used for fracking is water and sand. You've been a very vocal opponent of fracking. How come?
I see fracking as the mother of all of our problems right now in the U.S. in terms of the environmental crisis, because it is what is going to continue the fossil fuel party long after we should be declaring it over. And further investments in fossil fuels are essentially ruinous and unethical at this point. And just to speak substantively, fracking is, and the natural gas it produces can only be called clean energy in the narrowest of sense, meaning that if you compare natural gas to coal, when you light it on fire, it produces only half of the carbon dioxide that coal produces. However, two things. One, we're so far down the climate road now that simply swapping out natural gas for coal is not going to save us from climate catastrophe. That's not just me saying that. That is international bodies that have looked at climate change. So it's not clean enough compared to coal. Coal should not be the benchmark. We need absolutely clean energy, which is fossil fuel free energy. And second, when you back up and you include a whole life cycle analysis of the carbon footprint of natural gas via fracking, what you see is that there are so many leaks of methane, which that's what natural gas is, all along the system at every stage, from the moment the drill bit goes into the ground, from the compressor stations, the pipelines, the gas that flows under our cities and so forth. There are all these natural gas leaks all along the way. When unburned fugitive methane enters the atmosphere, over a 20-year period, it's 86 times more potent at trapping heat than is carbon dioxide. And over a 100-year time period, it's 30-some times more potent at trapping heat. And that's important because it means that even though at the point of combustion, natural gas might look a little cleaner than coal, when you look at the whole extraction process, it's virtually no different. A recent publication in Science magazine, which is one of our premier journals in the field of, across the sciences, demonstrates that a natural gas power plant, once you factor in the fugitive methane leaks, is not cleaner than coal for somewhere up to 60 or 70 years. So the difference is that natural gas methane is more potent at trapping heat, but doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide. So during the first few years or decades, a natural gas power plant is actually worse than coal. And it only becomes better if you factor in a time frame of about 100 years. But the climate scientists tell us we don't have 100 years to solve this problem. We only have maybe a decade at most. And so in swapping out coal for natural gas is too little too late to solve the problem. And then in addition, there are all these toxic problems created by fracking, which basically turns the earth inside out, introduces inherently toxic chemicals into the environment. Fracking creates air pollution wherever it goes. And we know that the well casings themselves, which transverse our drinking water aquifers, are not impervious forever. And so now we've threatened our source of drinking water too. So the price is too high for fracking. And it, more than anything else, it continues the addiction that we have to fossil fuels and prevents us from leaping into renewables. When, in fact, and this is sort of the data that I'll be airing when I visit, we have a wonderful blueprint now for how to decarbonize our economy. It's called the Solutions Project, and anyone can check out the website, thesolutionsproject.org, and take a look. This was developed by a Stanford scientist, Mark Jacobson, and his colleagues at Cornell and other universities, along with economists and people who know how to direct investment dollars and create jobs and so forth. And it involves a redirection of our energy system that would provide good, sustainable jobs, bring down our energy needs. In other words, by investments in efficiency and conservation, we don't need as much energy. And then wind, water, and solar power can provide what we do need over a certain time frame. It's a very convincing blueprint, and it stands as a kind of good example of what we could do and what I think we are ethically required to do at this moment in history.
One last thing I want to ask you about is PCB contamination. People in the city of Kalamazoo are waiting word from the Environmental Protection Agency about cleaning up a Superfund site here. What does living near that contamination do to people?
Well, we know a lot about PCBs here in New York State, which is where I live now, so I'll be talking about this, actually. The Hudson River is likewise contaminated with PCBs. So PCBs are kind of the Methuselah, if you will, of hydrocarbon molecules. They were originally synthesized from coal tar, and they last a long time in the environment. And they're semi-volatile, meaning that they'll evaporate, but not as rapidly as water. And so when these chemicals in a cold area like Michigan or New York begin to volatilize from soil or, in our case, in the Hudson River sediments, they end up kind of going into the air. It's cold. Their condensation point is reached. They come back down, and they can then insinuate themselves up the food chain. So we're mostly exposed by eating food. And because they're fat, they're soluble in fat, they end up in fatty animal products at their highest concentrations. And PCBs were outlawed in 1976, and I think they're a good model for what we should do with fracking when we decide that a technology is inherently unmanageable and we pay too high of a cost. We simply outlaw them. That's what we did with PCBs. That's what we did with smoking in airplanes. That's what we should do with fracking. But since they've been outlawed, because they last so long, we're all exposed, people in Michigan, people in New York, and we continue to pay a price, although not as high a price as we would if we had kept on manufacturing them. And that not only includes a risk for cancer, because many PCBs, and they're talked about in the plural because there's actually 206 different types of them. Some of them are carcinogens. Some of them actually have the power to shorten human gestation and make pregnancies shorter and contribute to preterm birth, one of the leading causes of disability in this nation. And then some of them actually, like lead, can go into the brain and extinguish IQ. So we've learned a lot more about PCBs since we've outlawed them. And that's the model I'm going to talk about with fracking, that yes, we need more scientific study on fracking, but you don't keep people in harm's way while the fracking is going on. And similarly with the whole tar sands experiment. So, I mean, I see Kalamazoo as a really important place to have this conversation because it's a place that has already experienced the largest spill of Canadian tar sands in the United States in the Kalamazoo River. We see now these civil disobedience, Vicki Hamlin, Lisa Leggio, and Barbara Carter facing charges for resisting and obstructing and peacefully protesting the expansion of the Enbridge tar sands pipeline right there in the community. We also have the example of PCBs in the area. And then Western Michigan is also in the crosshairs of the gas industry for fracking. So PCBs, tar sands, fracking, these will all be part of the conversation that I want to have in this place. And I can see no better place to have it than in Kalamazoo.
Sandra Steingraber, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ecologist and author Sandra Steingraber will read from her most recent book, Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, tomorrow night at Kalamazoo College. Her talk begins at 8 o'clock in the Light Fine Arts Dalton Theater. Steingraber's appearance is part of the Changing Climate series, sponsored by Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities.